Chapter 8. Doing Time. In the mid-sized college town of Urbana, Illinois, along the former Big Four and Wabash Railroad lines, there sits a picturesque little train station that served local passengers from 1923 until the line shut down in 1957. It's just as cute a little brick train station as you might imagine. In 1972, an enterprising group of long-haired hopheads, commies, took ownership of the building and established the station theater. The combination of open-minded citizenry, freaks, and the students from the local University of Illinois Theater Department, younger freaks, has made for 40 years of surprisingly high-end theater productions in the station's modest black box stage space. I am proud to have served my time as one of the enlisted weirdos at both the U of I and the station theater. During my delightfully hedonistic college career, I enjoyed performing in and building scenery for several productions at the latter, and I made some very good friends there among the Confederacy. Now, a word about live theater. A great many of you have likely never seen a production at your local small theater company. I urge you to correct that deficit, as live theater is loaded with a certain sense of altruism that cannot be found in any other art form. By engaging in the act of putting on a show, a theater is holding up a mirror to our hilarious and tragic human foibles, so that we, society, may see ourselves therein and thereby receive a dose of social medicine. That holding up a mirror line is not mine, by the way, but I can't remember who said it first, Aristotle or Hamlet. Banding together with others to achieve a common pursuit cannot help but engender a strong feeling of community, whether you're baling hay or mounting a chorus line in a tiny theater space. Thus, when you produce a play with friends, you feel very gratified to be contributing in some small way to the spiritual health of the community. Especially nice since you never stand to make any actual money. Theater artists are paid in the coin of an audience's laughter and tears, a sentiment which sounds corny, but let me assure you, is anything but. There is nothing so delicious to me as tickling a room full of people with a gesture or well-timed rejoinder. We thespians are doing our part to keep humanity on the road to decency and also to take a pie in the face so that everybody can enjoy a chuckle. Let me take this opportunity to again cajole all 37 of you who are still listening to this drivel to get out and see some live theater, music, art shows, etc. Is a movie more convenient? Yes. More spectacular? Most often, yes, in a superficial way, but more prone to mediocrity. There's a reason a night in the theater seems to take all night. It's not meant so much as a comfy diversion, like, say, watching an episode of the New Yankee Workshop, as it is an event in which to engage the hearts and minds of the audience. It's a bit more like church than your local multiplex because the performers, the celebrants, are there with you, the audience, participating with complicity in a rite. When you see a play and consider that the artists are pulling this show off every night, it's impressive in a much more immediate way than seeing James Bond jump over a hedge. Good theater is necessarily more viscerally engaging than other art forms because you, the audience, are participants. Movie theaters and stadium concerts have their advantages, sure, their pyro and their Dolby sound, but I will always prefer the intimacy of small theater plays and live music where I can see the details on the mandolin's pegboard. Seeing a performer's facial expression goes a long way towards experiencing his or her charisma. I can happily tell you from experience that watching Patty Griffin weave the spell of her songs in person spins an enchantment entirely superior to hearing her records, which are already amazing in their own right. In addition, while movie theaters are traditionally a place to get romantic, although please note that anything more than handwork is crossing the line, Seeing a musical or play with your date can be very stimulating to conversation and the stimulating cranial exploration necessary to further your relationship to the level of, well, stimulating. Theater to me is always a bigger turn-on than film. It's alive. Maybe if the play goes well, you can then catch a movie next time and tug and twaddle each other to your heart's content. Do as you please. Now that you know how I feel about participating in live theater, you can more fully grasp the sense of camaraderie and loyalty that thrived amongst we young initiates back in Urbana. It must have been 1990, after a summer performance of the Neil Simon classic Biloxi Blues at the Station Theater, that the infamous Boneyard bust occurred. Myself and two compatriots, Hardy Lads, Tatro and Craig, who was so skinny we had a contest to determine an appropriate nickname for him, after rejecting the likes of Wisp, Sliver, Wafer, and Spook, not to mention the generous estimation of T-Square, the winner was Line, we were sitting upon the large 2-foot diameter sewer pipe that spans the Boneyard Creek behind the theater and acts as a footbridge of sorts for the not so faint of heart. Aged 20 or 21, we three lads spent our days together in the U of I acting studio class of 92, but our nights, especially over the summer break, were consigned to the Station Theater. Like any self-respecting young aspiring actors, we were seriously involved in the study of smoking cigarettes, and the pipe bridge was a favorite classroom of ours. We settled comfortably upon the pipe and fired up our squares with Elan and My Zippo, our surroundings ideal for a real artistic think tank session, except for the annoying presence of someone using power tools across the creek somewhere in the darkness. This particular night, we were also sampling some of the illicit weed marijuana by means of a kick-ass new one-hitter and dugout box of teak with ebony and holly inlays that Tatro had purchased just that afternoon from Bogart's head shop. Puffing away, fulminating over the finer points of the new Dead Can Dance record, striking ne'er-do-well poses we thought worthy of a young Malkovich, John Malkovich, like Gene Hackman, remains a hero of my brand of actor, as he too matriculated in Central Illinois. We were aglow in the torrents of a bohemian reverie seldom achieved by any of we three before or since. Awash in the euphoria of Urbana's finest Mary Jane, we lost ourselves in the tinkling burble of the Boneyard's waters, echoed by the ghostly babble of water through the pipe beneath our bottoms, and the bobbing fairy-like lights along the bank upstream. It was a beautiful piece we had discovered there, as we lightly floated, buoyed upon an updraft of hallucination. That was right about when Line whispered, "Hey, you guys, those are flashlights." We each reluctantly tugged our consciousness back from its field of dreams to focus in on the flashlights searching the area 50 yards upstream across the creek. Yep, those were people. What could they—
"Cops," Tatro hissed. "Shit, what tickles?" "The fuzz," I said. "Ditch the weed."
"Right," he replied.
We slowly and carefully gained our feet so as to tiptoe back to the safety of our benevolent train station, gripped in the paranoia of the young, inexperienced stoner. When the police shouted,
"Stop! Hold it right there!"
we, of course, took off running like shit-faced squirrels in a blind panic. We scattered, and I'm not sure where my friends got to, but I made it around the theater and into the parking lot next door before being neatly tackled by a diminutive female officer who popped to her feet, placed her boot on my head, then pointed her pistol at a spot slightly below her boot. What in the fucking what? Hang on, whoa, please and thank you. This was all insanely wrong. What in the fuck was going on? In my estimation, toking up on the Boneyard did not equate with a gun to the head, not remotely. So I calmed down real quick-like. Okay, I don't think we did what you think we did, I sagely remarked, Save it, dipshit, she replied. She was impossibly tiny and incredibly scary. As my heartbeat slowed from the tempo of a twin-prop seaplane to the cadence of a playing card in a bicycle wheel, I saw that my two fellow dipshits had been welcomed similarly across the lot. The three of us, confused and terrified, were hustled and herded into three police cars and hauled all of the five odd blocks to the Urbana Sheriff Station, where we were kept in separate areas so we couldn't get our stories straight. As I was being deeply patted down and then booked, I whispered a silent thanks that Tatro had had the good sense to lose the weed. Thankfully, and due no doubt in part to the cornucopia of acting techniques we had all gleaned sponge-like from that legendary tome Acting One by Robert Cohen, we all three managed to explain to the baffled police interrogators that we had just been hanging out, talking, and smoking. You know, tobacco. This elicited repeated utterings on their part of, "Then why did you run?" To which they received an endless sequence of shrugs and unintelligible mutterings. Once this unfortunate graveyard shift of Urbana's finest copped to the reality that we were in fact relatively innocent, they filled us in on the malfeasance behind the whole night's episode. Apparently, those power tools we had heard across the creek, so obviously suspicious in hindsight, a skill saw at 12:30 a.m., were the sound of a team of thieves quite loudly breaking into a restaurant where, it turns out, was stashed a ridiculous amount of cash, about 20,000 bucks, I seem to recall. The robbers made off with the dough, and the police were notified thanks to an alarm system and a more alert neighbor than we pipe dwellers. The police had arrived to investigate what must have been, at least partially, an inside job, and as they were scanning the surrounding area for evidence, suddenly there were three young men in eyeliner fleeing in panic. Understandably, it seemed pretty obvious to them that we must be somehow attached to the caper, although we pointed out that if we were involved, it would have been pretty stupid to lurk about the scene of the crime once the money had been properly purloined. Right, guys? We all had a pretty good laugh by the time the ordeal had passed. We were released the next morning, after a nerve-wracking night in the Hooskow, just as the sun was coming up. Walking onto the front lawn of the police station, we laughed with relief that our freedom had survived the tests of the previous night. Comparing critiques of the prisoner's bathroom, Line and I were suddenly horrified to see Tatro reach into his crotch and produce his one-hitter box. He said, with the most righteous of indignation, "I just got this fucking thing yesterday. It was 45 bucks. I'm not about to toss it into the boneyard." Once I finished up the warm and free release of urine into my own jeans, and it seemed clear that no one was going to sound an alarm or unceremoniously tackle us onto the pavement, we each fired up a hit, exhaled, and felt the warming sunlight on our young relieved faces. We set off on foot to face the day and get a nap before the show that night. We had been, and we remained, men of the theater. The moral of this story? Clearly, when the popo give you a hassle, stand your ground and talk to them. Don't run. Just be cool. One minor detail that may have further colored my character in the eyes of the officers that night, adding to our collective suspiciousness, was the fact that I had a record. That's right, a rap sheet. The Boneyard bust was not, in fact, my first dalliance with the Urbana Sheriff's Department. Let's rewind the tape to the previous autumn. Rewind the tape is what we said in my youth when audiovisual content was recorded on media tape, wound or rolled around reels in an actual cassette. It's fucking crazy, kids, like wiping your ass with a corn cob. Anyway, the previous autumn, so 1989. As a sophomore in the theater acting conservatory at the University of Illinois, I was newly eligible to be cast in feature productions, also known as fresh meat. The department produced 2 main stage and 2 studio plays per semester, for which the entire body of eligible actors, 50 or 60 strong, would audition at the beginning of each semester. Each auditioning actor would perform 2 contrasting monologues for all 4 play directors at once. The directors would then hold callbacks, and the actors they liked for each role would come back and read specific material, often with other actors, to get a look at chemistry and physical size matchups and what have you. Then the directors would go behind closed doors and engage in a sweaty round of horse trading, motherfucking, and mollycoddling to try to land the best actors in their own shows. According to apocryphal student legend, a staggering quantity of oral and manual pleasuring was exchanged between faculty in these negotiations. For example, rumor had it that scoring Michael Shapiro as your Jaques or your Sky Masterson cost 2 rim jobs and a finger blast. He really was much sought after. It was his sublimely wry enunciation more than anything. Finally, a 4-show casting list would be posted on the hallway bulletin board with everyone's casting assignment for that half year. Again, youngsters, public announcements used to be made using paper hung in 1 physical location. Hilarious, right? You had to walk to the location to see the news. Further, can you imagine the drama that unfurled at this posting? Children and young adults having dedicated their lives to embodying the tender renderings of history's most sensitive playwrights, publicly witnessing the joyful tidings of a whole semester's work, or else the devastating lack thereof. Oh, there was wailing. Oh boy, there were tears. There was indeed gnashing of teeth. P.S. If you think you might end up gnashing your teeth in public, send a friend to read the casting and bring you the news in private. Looking at you, Greenberg. Yes, there also leapt jubilation, and at times deafening caterwauls of sheer elation shook the building to its roots. But the real show was in the disappointments. For many young hopefuls, having chosen an admittedly dicey program of study to begin with in regards to future chances of financial stability, on Mom and Dad's dime, no less, the casting sheet could spell the doom of their entire life's dream. If the theater department didn't see you as a Juliet, or Lady Capulet, or even a lady-in-waiting, then the Actors Theater of Louisville was goddamned unlikely to think so either, let alone Chicago. God damn it, honey, we tried it your way. We got you the colored contacts, we got you the LeBaron convertible. You won raves as 80 Annie at Glenbard South, and rightly so. You really were just magical. You really were. And I know everyone says you look like a young Julie from the Love Boat, and you do. You could be your sister. Your mother and I bought into it, too. It was intoxicating. I mean, we were all 3 of us giddy with delight at your prospects. We were drunk is what we were. On your talent. But you didn't get cast in Romeo and Juliet, in Champaign, Urbana. Nor did you get cast in 3 Sisters, or the House of Blue Leaves, or Kabuki Achilles, whatever the hell that is. 47 actors got parts. You did not, Monica. So now you will, by God, get a degree in poli-sci like we always thought you should in the first place. You get the idea. I myself was very much a newborn baby in acting school, which is to say that I was not very good at acting, which really is to say I was bad at acting at this point in my training. So, as this was my own first time through the ringer, I didn't have high hopes to begin with. I did dream that I might just have a crack at the leading man role in William Inge's American classic Picnic, just because there weren't a lot of manly types in the department. William Holden plays Hal in the movie version, a rough-and-tumble drifter in jeans and no shirt. Mumble, brood, mumble, smoke, flex, spit, kiss the girl. Right up my alley. We got into the callbacks, and lo and behold,
The director had the same idea, so suddenly I was reading opposite lovely ladies in scenes for Hal and Madge. Everything was cool. A little too cool, it turns out. For right about then, this new grad student showed up, a man named David. Nice fella. His main focus had been the ballet, a fact, but now he was leaning toward theater. He was hairless, he was slightly effeminate, and he was ripped. He was sweet as pie, the kind of guy who would never upset you unless he was cast instead of you to portray a virile, swaggering cowboy. As we continued to pair off in the callback scenes, the director eventually had David try one with his shirt off. And I knew immediately that it was over. The director turned out to be the sort of chap who didn't necessarily cast the best actor for the part based on ability. He cast the best actor for the part based on tits. There are, sadly, astonishingly, too many directors in this world who operate similarly. But such is life. Hey, tits are nice. I get it. If I had succeeded in my life thanks to my sweet tits, I imagine I'd be singing a different tune. I'm certain that we've all suffered defeat at one time or another at the hands of a lesser foe who just happened to be brandishing better tits. David was a fine actor, certainly my better in that regard, but he was simply miscast as a manly person in jeans and cowboy boots. In any case, I was barely given time to foment my sour grapes, because unfortunately, there is more to the story. You see, this director also liked the cut of my particular jib, despite my medium tits, so he turned right around and started reading me in the scenes for Alan. Who is Alan, you ask? Oh, just the milquetoast college boy who is publicly emasculated when Hal poaches his girlfriend Madge, and she chooses to acquiesce to her animal desires, succumbing to Hal even though he has trouble written all over him. For Hal is a man, my friends, and Alan is merely a boy. A cuckolded boy, no less. Alan the boy even has a crying scene, downstage center, lamenting the loss of his gal to this bohunk. So, now, not only am I pissed that David the dancer is going to handily unman me by playing Hal, but all the bookish, boyish actors who thought they had Alan sewn up are damning my eyes. Fortune presents gifts not according to the book, friends. A lesson I have learned too many times to mention. The casting was over, the list was mounted upon the hallway board, I was to play Alan. Very well. I put my shoulder to the wheel and tried as hard as I could to accomplish some semblance of good scene work. Boy, howdy, did I try. I never came close that fall, or for a few years beyond it, because what I had to ultimately learn was that I needed to be trying less. I'll save the rest for my acting technique book. Coming This Never from E.P. Dutton, an imprint of Penguin Random House. The important thing was that I tried my best, and I never gave up. And I could even discern that, although I had a lot farther to go in my journey, the audience at least understood the words I was speaking. I've always taken my small victories wherever I could find them. Now I'm 43, and I am happy to report that I still have even a lot farther to go. But goddamn, folks, I'm a good sight better now than I was during that picnic autumn. Anyway, we were talking about crime. Joe Faust was a year older than me, and he was also more mature in some very practical ways, which I admired. He was not so mature, however, that he wouldn't join me in our favorite running joke, shoplifting stupid items. It was hilarious. We'd try to outdo each other, with an item's uselessness being the key value for scoring points toward an intangible victory. A box of panty liners, granny glasses, a book of Bible verses for dealing with fatal diseases. Hilarious, right?
Being 19 was amazing. I was an unstoppable pilferer. We would exit the chosen establishment, barely containing our mirth until we could pull out whatever dumb trinket we had just heisted. Then we would laugh. Oh, how we would double over and cackle in the glow of the parking lot lights. What could be more fun than pointless petty larceny? Fracking, maybe? One day, we went to the Kmart so Joe could purchase a microwave for his girlfriend for Christmas. I wandered innocuously about while he selected his oven and paid. Then, as we sauntered out, the security man said, "Excuse me, can I please talk to you?" "Yeah," I replied, thoroughly amazed that they had somehow detected my thievery. He asked to examine the front of my jeans, and sure enough, there he found not 4, not 5, not even 6, but 8 Ronnie Millsap cassettes. 8 Ronnie Millsap cassettes. Please hit pause on your player to calm your exploding heart rate. All good? To resume. 8 Ronnie Millsap cassettes. 8 disparate Ronnie Millsap albums on cassette. You have to admit that was an amazing haul in terms of scoring points in our game. I had apparently shoved them into the front of my jeans, standing directly in front of a two-way mirrored security window. The man took me back to his office to show me where he had been sitting whilst watching me commit my smooth misdemeanor. His chair behind the mirror was about 14 feet from the display of country greats on sale. I said that I felt pretty stupid and that it was actually just a hilarious joke and that I wasn't actually even familiar with Mr. Millsap's stylings. He told me that if I could pay for the tapes right then, he'd let me go. I remember the total being about $17 and change. I did not have it. He said he was sorry, but he'd have to call the police in then. I stoically said, "Well, that's your call, but I fucking won, bro." So, puzzled at my bravado, he did. That Kmart bastard had the rectitude to call the fucking cops. Imagine hearing my end of that call. "Hey, Dale, it's Cleve." "Heh, it's hanging." "I got one for you." "Nah, white boy." "You ready?" "8 Ronnie Millsap tapes." "Ronnie Millsap." "8. "Nope, 8. "He says it's hilarious." "All right, see ya." It suddenly dawned on me that this might not be so great, because in about 5 hours I was supposed to appear in the opening night performance of Picnic. Oh my good Jesus. A deputy came from the sheriff's office and arrested me and cuffed me and walked me out of the store in front of all the mothers pulling their children in close to them, and my friend Joe, who quickly communicated that he didn't think the Ronnie Millsap tapes were really that funny in this instance. He was just pissed because I had driven us there in my Subaru Brat, and he couldn't drive a stick, so he was stranded. In an attempt to further diminish my ultimate victory, he pointed out that he had written a check, with our address on it, for the microwave, so it wasn't really the ideal setup for lifting humorously useless objects. As he spoke, all I heard was, "You are the ultimate champion forever of our awesome game." The deputy said something like, "Okay, let's move along. Now gird yourself, we're about to pass some Engelbert Humperdinck cassettes." Then he shoved me past the candy bars and out the door. The whole pageant was meant to cow and shame me, and it worked, like a charm. It was an intense wake-up call to suddenly be handcuffed in the back of a police car, heading downtown at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. My life as I knew it was about to come to a screeching halt, for this was the worst possible night I could have chosen to be unwillingly detained by the law. Visions of Sean Penn and Isai Morales from Bad Boys, the 1983 film, filled my mind's eye, and I expected, upon arriving up the river, to soon find myself garnished with the hocked-up loogies of my new, jeering fellow inmates. I was taken into the station and booked, straight up. The sheriff's deputies told me that, due to my tender years, they would go pretty easy on me. I'd be released that day if I posted bail, then I'd have to return to a sort of lightweight court for sentencing, which would probably be a fine or community service. I started to think that I might just find my way clear of this bed I had just shat. Suck on that, Isai Morales. By the way, I've always been such a fan of his that I used to dream of growing up to be called the White Isai Morales. Shortly after I arrived in the Urbana joint, my friend Goliath, alerted by Joe Faust, showed up with my bail, which I think was about $250. Good man. Seems I was all set to get off easy. And it was here, right at this goddamn point, that I made my second biggest mistake of the afternoon. It was in the words that I spoke aloud to the fine officers processing me. Gentlemen, I want to say to you that I am truly sorry that I committed this grave error this afternoon, and I can assure you that I am and will remain sincerely repentant. I am a jackass of the first order. This is now clear to me. Jack-ass totally. I mean, wow, guys, officers, I have learned a lesson here. A lesson and a half has been learned. And now, if you wouldn't mind, hustling my paperwork along, expediting it, as they say, for you see, I am a student of the theater, and tonight is actually the opening night of my play, Picnic, on the main stage over at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, so it's pretty much a big deal, and it's my first show ever, because I'm a sophomore, and they have a whole hierarchy pecking order kind of thing, where they post the casting on the board. So anyway, my call time is 6:30 for an 8 p.m. show. It's 5 o'clock now, so thanks for the hustle. The officers kindly looked at one another and said to me, "Opening night? You don't say. That sounds important, all right. Don't you worry, buddy. We'll take care of it. We love the arts around here." Amazing. I sighed my relief all over them. I made my gratitude very clear to the deputies, and I don't believe I cried. I flashed back to my Grandpa Ray telling me years earlier, "You made your bed, now you have to sleep in it." I briefly hated that beloved man, now gone, for the painfully appropriate timbre of his aphorism. How close had I just come to bringing the curtain of justice down upon the closing night of my whole shebang? This was seriously, seriously bad. Missing the show for such a delinquent reason would certainly see me expelled from school, and so I would not have blamed myself for crying, but I believe I kept it together. I'm one hell of an optimist, is all it is. Such a sunny disposition can make a body powerfully stupid some of the time, but it's mostly worked out for me so far. Blissful ignorance, I believe, is the operative phrase. The officers had put me relatively at ease, and then they put me in the holding cell right there across from them. I could see them through a large window, but I couldn't hear. 5:30 p.m. 6 p.m. Everyone seemed pretty calm. Immobile, really. Hold up. I didn't need to hear. My eyes were all the equipment I required to deduce that the men wearing the uniforms had not lifted a finger since putting me in the cell. The clock was ticking. 6:15. Oh my lord. What? Fucking what now? The bail had been posted. Goliath was waiting to drive me to the theater, a mere 15-minute trip or less. And all that remained was for these sons of bitches to punch my ticket and show me the door. 6:30. Holy Jesus and Mary and Joseph. My misstep dawned on me slowly as I watched the two deputies look innocently at each other with the very slightest of smirks, then continue reading the newspaper. Feet up on the desk, the whole bit. Holy shit. 7 o'clock. Motherfuck. Finally, the penny dropped. I cottoned to my precise dilemma just before I banged on the window to communicate that I was indeed shitting little green apples in there. I saw their game. I comprehended the bit, and so I waited. They were fucking with me. They wanted the idiot in the headband, the one with the Ronnie Millsap tapes. Oh, fuck, what if they were huge Millsap fans? And the opening night to at least sweat a little bit. Right? What a dipshit I must have sounded to them. What a dipshit I was, in fact. I most certainly obliged them, as I did readily sweat some bullets and also some Brazil nuts and a few lumps of rock salt as well. My time in the joint, my stint, had run up to literally dozens of minutes by now, plenty of time to think about where I'd go from here, a hardened criminal with a record. I suppose I'd go back to framing houses in Manuka, my hometown. My sweet parents would be so disappointed in me, the most decent people I had ever come across about to be handed back this steaming pile of a son. It was 7:38 when the fuzz finally roused themselves to emancipate your pudding-headed author. Man, they thought they were pretty goddamn funny. I did not have time to join them in their mirth, however. Goliath violated some speed limits, flagrantly, on the way down Green Street to the stage door of the theater, and I sprinted into the dressing room with about 7 or 8 minutes to get it together. Slapped on some makeup and threw on my loafers and yellow cardigan. Alan, remember? Our assistant director, Mike Siegel, a friend, had gotten wind of my predicament and covered for me with some little white fabrication or other, and before I knew it, I was clumsily blubbering through my crying scene in Act Two. Most definitely the best crying scene I've ever delivered. I was saved. Did I mention that I got lucky every now and again? The final chapter saw me called in front of a court of kindly and august senior citizens, who I dare say saw me for what I was, a harmless dumbass. When one sweet grandmother complimented my work in Picnic, I knew I was sitting pretty. After sincerely communicating to them that I had learned my lesson, I was gratified to hear that my sentence would consist of a mere 100 hours of community service. I was shown a list of departments to choose from, and I went with animal control. Easy. Did anybody ever choose sanitation? With no exaggeration whatsoever, I can report that I spent some weekends helping sorority girls look at puppies at the Humane Society. It was not too hard to swallow, to be honest. Confirming my absolute reputation as an asswipe, I didn't even show up for the entirety of the 100 hours, and I never did hear from anybody about it. Yes, you are correct. I was a douche. Now, friends, what can we take away from this cautionary tale? I do think it's important to behave rebelliously when leaving the nest and striking out on one's own, but I would suggest coming up just short of breaking the law. If you are going to burglarize a retail establishment, for Christ's sake, case the joint ahead of time. Also, don't ever underestimate the value of Ronnie Millsap. Be smart while getting stupid. When the work is done, then we deserve to play. After 10 sweaty hours in the wood shop, when I'm covered in sawdust, that first Corona tastes like the jizz of the Lord. Which has to be the most magnificent beverage, right? The libation of glory. And in my life, one of my greatest leisure time pleasures has been smoking a bong in the living room before settling down with the new episode of Twin Peaks, or maybe a Jim Jarmusch film. Dead Man? Heaven. Or some animation or claymation. Akira? Wallace and Gromit? Sublime. Therefore, if I had to choose one god to serve, I would choose Dionysus, the Greek god of wine, song, and theater. My Eucharist is found in entertaining people, receiving the bread and wine of laughter and tears from the crowd, and being brought to catharsis by the work of others. When I take the stage, Dionysus, or Bacchus, sees and hears my ministry, and he is muchly pleased. Or she. No reason to stick to the tired dogma of the patriarchy. I like to engage in revelry. I like to celebrate the human experience through performance. I like to engender mirth. I like to abide pleasure with my body, and one way that we funny monkeys have learned to know delight is through the consumption of intoxicants. All splendid treats in the proper dosage, but just like religion, the opiate of the masses, you can use them responsibly and do good, or you can use them like an asshole and ruin it for the rest of us who just want to get a little high and look at a maple leaf. Let's have a look at our choices, shall we? Number 1, wine and beer. The workhorses. You keep these expendables in stock, like paper towels and salt. And just like salt, you will enjoy them throughout your life as long as you don't overdo it. Beer, in all its infinite varieties these days, is obviously one of the staples of life. For a pint of beer, you can never beat Guinness or Old Rasputin. In the life of the theater professional, 3 pints a night in the local public house is simply a part of one's workday, and it's nice work if you can get it. My leisure time was dominated by beer throughout my youth and into my 20s because wine just didn't have much of a foothold in my part of the Midwest. Aunt Dee would drink white wine, but then she always was a bit fancy. I never understood what all the fuss was about until my wife bought a really nice bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon on New Year's Eve 2000. We were at a beautiful cabin in Santa Barbara, and we counted down the last hours of our first 8 months together as we sipped this red wine that made my head and body feel like delicious candy. I'm not talking about shitty candy, which also has its place of honor, your Skittles, your Willy Wonka varietals, your Paydays. No, I'm talking about handmade, rich people candy. This wine? Fermented grape juice, mind you. Tasted and felt like Edmund's description of Turkish delight in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And buddy, I signed up as, and I remain, a card-carrying member of the Wine Enthusiasts Club. For lo, it is some good shit. Number 2. Whiskey and the Lesser Spirits. Try to utilize the hard liquors with less frequency than you do beer. Did I spend a period of my youth chugging Jim Beam? Sure I did, as it provided a swift and complete oblivion, which is sometimes what we're looking for in life. That was a thankfully brief stint when I was despairing of ever finding a lady who could stand me and one whom I could tolerate in return. Once I got my head on straight, I learned that bourbons exist to rival even the qualities of Jim Beam. Furthermore, I discovered Irish and Scotch whiskies, to which I remain devoted. For a single malt Scotch, Lagavulin will never disappoint. It's practically furry. I'll be happy to further enumerate the admirable qualities of whiskey consumption over a glass of the good stuff should you ever catch me out at the bar. Number 3. Nitrous oxide, N2O, laughing gas, or whippets? Old friend. Not just at the dentist anymore. For those of you who have deprived yourselves of this brief delight, please hustle out to the store and pick up several cans of ready-to-squirt whipped cream and let the fun begin. The cream remains in the can, fully wasted, as the propellant nitrous oxide enters your lungs and thereby your circulatory system. You will experience a lightheaded euphoria, as well as auditory hallucinations, culminating in smiles of glee or laughter. If you want to consume this goodness without wasting all that yummy dairy product, go to the gourmet store and purchase a case or 3 of N2O cartridges and a whipped cream charger. Or buy a little twist cracker at your local head shop and empty your cartridge into a pretty balloon. Load up a hit, put on Echolalia by Dead Can Dance, and drink deep, chum. Find a nice place to recline and listen to any good noises, a freight train, a subway, a waterfall, a Wilco show. Just sit where the popo won't be hassling you. Good, clean fun. I've seen friends fall down and go boom whilst using this stuff, so maybe keep your seat. Number 4. Weed. Sweet, sweet lady. Marijuana is quite possibly the finest of intoxicants. It has been scientifically proven for decades to be much less harmful to the body than alcohol when used on a regular basis. If you don't believe me, Google science. I applaud and support all of the legalization efforts perpetually underway in our country, but I kind of doubt it's going to make it all the way through the federal legal system until Big Tobacco wakes up and gets behind it. I'm calling you out, RJ. Step right up to your face and diss you, Philly Morris. You continue to cling to the legality of your carcinogenic smoking product that has been outlawed in most public spaces in America, but do you not see the potential in Marlboro Green? Own it! Regulate it! Tobacco will be going away, you know it. You have seen that writing on the wall. Turn that acreage over to cannabis, my brothers. People are constantly committing crimes whilst under the influence of, or looking for funding for, every other intoxicant besides marijuana. I am a super sweet teddy bear, but when I drink tequila, I want to knife somebody. When a person injects heroin, I've read, they want to lie in bed and drool with pleasure, listening to Coltrane's Giant Steps until the fix wears off, then they want to go out and threaten to knife somebody to get money for more heroin so they can get back to drooling on their pillow. When I smoke pot, I want to look at nature and laugh about everything and eat some delicious things and then sleep. For Willie's sake, do the math. Number 5. Mushrooms. Yes, indeed. The gentle brother of the hallucinogen family. All the giggles and visuals without the chemical jaw grinding and speedy after effects of Big Brother LSD. I remember one beautiful day in the woods of Allerton Park near Monticello, Illinois, tripping on shrooms with my brother, Falcon Smoker. Looking at leaves and trees, swimming in the river, listening to the birds and frogs and wood nymphs' song, gulping in the sweet air and glory of living, then winding down to wait out the waves of sensory bliss so we could head home. Once we were somewhat straightened out, we set off for home, blasting Ennio Morricone's magnificent soundtrack to The Mission, particularly track 12, called River. And in the early dark on the highway, all the other taillights looked like X-wing fighters, which lent a comforting perception of nostalgia to the ride. Treat your intoxicants with respect, and they will do right by you. Number 6. Amyl nitrate or poppers. Not worth it. Small head rush, massive brain cell carnage, often followed by a splitting headache. Might as well huff glue. Number 7. Glue. I've tried some and gotten the most profound effects from that crazy blue PVC plumbing adhesive, but it's a very low-grade high. Your head feels dirty inside, probably from all the poison from the glue. Pass. Huffing vapors is the intoxicant of true desperation. Number 8. Chicharrones, cracklins, or pork rinds. Not technically an intoxicant, but you could never tell me that. My buddy Pat Roberts and I were hooked on those bubbly, crunchy skin chips, and we had it bad. The great thing about this snack food is that it's mostly protein and therefore much healthier than most of the garbage Frito-Lay is churning out. No offense, Frito-Lay. I love a bag of Doritos as much as the next Midwesterner, but I've read all of Michael Pollan's books, so let's just call it like it is. To place my pork skin problem chronologically, let's just say it went real nice with Jim Beam and Virginia Blister peanuts for dessert. Keep the peanut can for loose hardware, and you've done your part for Mother Earth today.